Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. So I'm going to get on my soapbox. Do you ever think about where that comes from? I believe that back in the day, people with political opinions would actually stand on a soapbox, a wooden box that was used to hold soap, commercial soap, and speak their mind, preach their faith, possibly talk about their politics. I remember a guy. This takes me back. I was in downtown LA last weekend, and I remember a guy who used to be on the corner of, I think it was 6th and Hope down in downtown LA. And he had a little box that he stood on, and he had a little mic, and he would tell us repeatedly that we were all going to hell. And you could hear that cry echoing through the tall buildings in downtown LA. And it's sort of part of the lens, the audioscape of my childhood now that I think about it. So I'm getting on my soapbox, and we're going to talk about physics, e-bikes, and helmets, and stop signs. My first point, stop signs are for everybody. I've been very disturbed by a recent phenomenon I've been noticing in my area of Santa Cruz, California. People, mostly young, riding on e-bikes, who ignore stop signs and ride blithely through stop signs, changing lanes without looking and just kind of cruising along. Many of these people aren't wearing helmets, and those that are seem to be choosing helmets that are, well, to me, they look like they're too thin to meet CPSC standards. There is a website that tells you all about bike helmets. It's called helmets.com. It's obviously been around for a while. Thin helmets look cool, but they can't really protect your brain as well as thicker designs because you need to distribute the force. So I said we'd be giving you physics. Here's some physics. Force equals mass times acceleration or deceleration. So when two objects collide, the more massive object, let's say a truck, transfers its force to the smaller, softer object, say the bike rider's body. Cars have bumpers and crumple zones. People have bones instead of crumple zones, and solid organs, which rupture like a dropped watermelon when they get too much force. Rapid acceleration and deceleration is what kills you. Your body accelerates away from the impact until it either runs out of momentum or spends it on the pavement or hits something else. Here are some numbers. You and your bike weigh perhaps 200 pounds. The car weighs 4,000 pounds. Thus, the car delivers all its momentum in the instant of collision. That's a lot of energy. If you were to drive into a brick wall at 4 miles per hour, you would absorb, in that moment, because the wall doesn't move at all, 200 Gs. This would create a massive compression of your flesh before you bounce away. And here's the big problem. Your brain is packed fairly loosely inside your skull. So as you accelerate away from the impact, your brain slams into the inside of your skull on the side of the impact. Then when you decelerate, the opposite side of your brain strikes the other side of the interior of the skull. This is called a contraclusion. And actually, the damage to the brain is worse the second time it hits. Skidding down the road 50 feet and losing a lot of skin is better for your brain than being thrown into a parked car. You really, really, really don't want either one. 79% of bike fatalities in New York were in helmetless riders. 97% of bike fatalities in New York were in helmetless rider. If a car going 20 miles per hour hits an e-bike rider broadside, which is what's going to happen if you run stop signs, the peak force is around the same as falling from a two-story building. If it's a delivery truck going 30 miles per hour, it's more like three or four stories. You're unlikely to walk away from either one. And if you hit a parked car or some other immovable object, the damage can increase tenfold. Everyone out there in cars, you can help. Honk and yell at people who run stop signs. Honk if there's no helmet, and if they look, point at your head. Give them a wide-eyed, are you crazy look. Maybe it'll help. Let's see if a little preemptive aversion therapy can save a few lives. And if you're in law enforcement, can we start enforcing helmet laws, please? I know it seems ridiculous or hard to chase down someone on an e-bike and you're worried you're going to cause probably more risk to them because they're going to be stupid enough to run away, maybe. I don't know what we do about that, but we've got to do something because this is a healthcare crisis in the making, and we need all the intact brains that we've got to get ourselves out of the fix that we are backing ourselves into, or I should say, they're one of the many fixes that we're backing ourselves into, because they're a few. All right, so let's go to our first email, and this one comes from Nyanko in Santa Cruz, and it's about hydroxyapatite, which is also found in bones. Hydroxyapatite began at NASA in the late 1960s and early 1970s. A researcher named Bernard Rubin was studying crystal growth in silica gel for making high-quality crystals for electronics. He noticed the way calcium phosphate crystals grew resembled how the mineral hydroxyapatite forms in teeth and bones. NASA was very interested in ways to help astronauts avoid losing bones and tooth minerals during long space missions. Following this work of Dr. Rubin, a Japanese company, Sangi Company Limited, acquired the relevant NASA patent in the mid-1970s. By 1980, Sangi had created the world's first toothpaste using nanohydroxyapatite for remineralizing teeth. It took until 1993 for Japan's government to officially recognize Sangi's form of hydroxyapatite, called medical hydroxyapatite, as an active anti-cavity ingredient. Studies comparing hydroxyapatite to fluoride toothpaste shows that it is just as effective in preventing cavities. It works by filling in small cracks and fissures where bacteria can get in and take root and grow. It is most effective at keeping cavities from getting started. It does, once the bacteria have gotten in there and have taken root, it is less effective. Another thing that it works for is painful teeth. So as we age, our enamel thins, and we also, if you're people who clench your jaws, which how is it possible not to be a person who clenches their jaws? She asks. But anyway, if you clench your jaw, you're going to get little cracks, little micro fractures. And those represent a place that can allow heat and cold to get to the dentin, which is the inside of the tooth. And it's painful. People with temperature sensitivities who use the remineralizing toothpastes will get relief from that because they will be essentially getting those spots grouted out and therefore restoring the barrier function of the tooth enamel. So strongly urged to those in my audience who have a problem with temperature sensitivity to give that a try. You may get some substantial relief. This is sort of so appropriate, I think, for this area. The origins of hallucinations are traced to specialized brain cells. Santa Cruz is the proud home of one of the world's primary research entities looking at the use of psychedelics in medical therapy. So it's too cool to be reading this story here. Researchers from the University of California at Berkeley and the Allen Institute in Seattle used lasers to record and stimulate the activity of neurons in mice to learn how the brain processes and interprets optical illusions. Their study may also have applications to artificial intelligence, helping researchers to examine whether machine vision systems can perceive illusions in the same way that humans do, said Hyung Shin, the paper's lead author. Scientists carried out the study by inserting tiny electrodes into the brains of mice. Each brain is about the size of a pea, and then recording the way that brain cells talk to each other. With these electrodes, we recorded neurons in a similar way to how astronomers watch thousands of stars in the sky. Picture that you're looking at all those stars, but there's a transmission line between each of them, and you have to think that each star is connected to 10,000 other stars. The stars in the analogy are actually neurons in the brain, the cells that send electrical and chemical signals through the body, allowing the brain and other organs to communicate. A new study illuminated the role played by a very select group of neurons in the visual cortex, the area of the brain that receives and processes information from the eye's retina. There are specialized cells that use the information they receive to fill in the information that is missing, constructing reality rather than simply receiving it. We all have a blind spot in our eye, and that blind spot is where the vessels come in to the back of the eye to feed the retina, and the retina being a data center, so to speak, is extremely energy intensive, which is why your vision browns out before you faint, because you just can't supply the screen, so to speak. Anyway, so all entities with eyeballs, at least all mammals, have this problem, and so this is a very early thing. And what it does is it basically extrapolates from what's on the right and what's on the left of the blind spot and simply fills it in so that you see it as if it was really there. And because the eye is always sweeping around in minute jerky motions, you're able to have a pretty accurate view of what is in the blind spot, because the blind spot keeps changing and you have a memory, so you fill in from the previous data before it blacked out. So it's a very efficient process. These cells are known as IC encoder neurons. They fill in the missing information, allowing the brain to complete the shapes and patterns in an optical illusion. So one very cool illusion is called the Canessa triangle. And I'm going to suggest those of you who are near a screen or a phone, and check this one out. Canizsa. In the most common version of the illusion, there are three Pac-Man like figures that mark the corners of a triangle, and the mouth of the Pac-Man is pointing in from the corners of the triangle. Our brains fill in the triangle and see it as brighter than it actually, than the surrounding objects. So it's both exaggerated, and even though there's no lines tracing out the triangle, our brain, because of the way it's wired, actually creates this triangle. It's an optical illusion, and it's different from the, like, is it the cup or is it the face kind of optical illusion. In this illusion, you really see that triangle. So go look up a picture of it online. It's really kind of fun. There is also a Canessa square, but I don't find the result on that one so compelling. So although it's too early to make predictions about possible treatments for schizophrenia, they postulate that if the pattern-completing circuits in the brain become active at the wrong moment, this may help trigger hallucination. Shin and her colleagues discovered the behavior of the IC encoder neurons by showing mice illusory images like the Canessa triangle and recording their brain activity. They then stimulated the neurons using a second laser, but this time without showing the mice the illusion, and they found that the mice displayed the same brain activity as if they had been shown the illusion. Illusions, let's get our definition straight here. Illusions and hallucinations are not the same. Illusions occur when the brain perceives something different from the image the eyes see. So think about, a classic movie trope where someone comes around the corner and they think they see a man looming towards them, and it turns out that it's a coat on a coat rack with a hat on it and, you know, some other innocuous object forming the arm. That's an illusion. Hallucinations come because the brain is completely making up something that isn't there. So while the study is primarily about a study of how perception works, it has implications for any mental health disorder where perception is affected. Another researcher, who is a research scientist at Google, named Dilip George and did not participate in the Nature neuroscience study, said the researchers asked the right questions and were able to do some pretty amazing experiments in the mice. In an email, George explained, "Our brains predict what we'll see, and to avoid confusion, they need to keep a clear separation between those predictions, the actual sensations, and our final belief about reality. In any crosstalk can result in the brain believing that its anticipated perceptions are the reality." George has studied and worked on models of visual perception. He showed in one paper that it's possible to develop computer models that can trick the blurry text captchas, which website visitors must solve to prove they're human. Now, this is the text captchas, not the image captchas, although I do wonder about the ability of AI to solve those sometime soon as well. Seeing hallucinations is more common than some might think. A 2021 study in the British Journal of Psychiatry found that hallucinations varied by age, from a high of 7% in people 16 to 19 to a low of 3% in people 70 or older. According to the paper, hallucinations were associated with an increased risk of mental disorders. There is, in fact, a version, I would call it a cousin of Parkinson's, called frontal temporal dementia. And in frontal temporal dementia, visual hallucinations are a strong part of the disease. This is because the protein that lodges in the substantia nigra in people with Parkinson's lodges in, among other places, the occipital cortex in people with this disease. The hallucinations experienced by people with schizophrenia and schizoaffective disorders include sounds as well as images, and they're not typically or necessarily shocking or nightmarish. Michelle Hammer, a 37-year-old mental health advocate in New York, I imagine she picked that profession because of her experience, was diagnosed with schizophrenia at 22. And she describes it that sometimes she would be sitting at her desk working and see a face. It's not totally real, 100% there. It's more like seeing someone in your peripheral vision. But I'll completely start talking to the person, not realizing and I'm doing it until someone else says, "What are you doing?" Existing medications, she say, just make it bearable. Sometimes other people see her making a strange face and she'll try to make it clear, I wasn't looking at you. Mostly, I just shrug it off because, hey, this is New York City. If you see me talking to myself, it's not the weirdest thing you're going to see all day. I always thought that when the little earpieces came out, you know, the first ones, and people started talking on their phones, but their phones were in their pocket, that really made it hard to tell who was schizophrenic and who was just talking on their phone. Great camouflage if you actually are schizophrenic. If you haven't seen it, there's a wonderful movie with Russell Crowe called A Beautiful Mind. In this movie, he plays John Nash, a very, very important person in game theory. Nash won the Nobel Prize in 1994, and as usual, it was for work he did as a graduate student. The Nash equilibrium is a game theory thing that says that if you know the other people's strategy, it's not going to change your own strategy. And it makes me think he worked a lot on the prisoner's dilemma. So I'll remind you that the prisoner's dilemma, as John Nash worked with it, was about being in jail. and you have two people who are in cells next to each other. They cannot communicate with each other in this version. You testify against the other guy, you get off, you leave prison. They testify against you, and you don't testify against them, you're going up for 10 years. If you both testify against each other, then you're going to go up for 1 year, both of you. So the idea is, do you anticipate that the other person's going to testify against you? Because if you do, the smart move is for you to testify against them, even if it's a lie. That way you get off with 1 year in prison. Another way of framing it is with money. If you do the thing and the other person doesn't do the thing, you get 10 bucks. If you both do the thing, you each get $2. And if neither of you does the thing, you don't get anything. The solution to that version of the prisoner's dilemma depends upon whether people can communicate. And what I love about this is the solution is that if they can communicate, one of the prisoners says, I am going to betray. I am going to not cooperate. But when I get the 10 bucks, I'll split it with you. And so we'll each end up with 5 instead of each ending up with 2. And if you think about it for a moment, that actually works. And the first time you do it, there's trust involved. But after that, it makes a lot of sense to cooperate and collaborate rather than opt out, because you've got more money in your pocket at the end. This sort of thing was very big in the 50s because people were running all kinds of Cold War scenarios in their head, and it made a really serious difference in how people approached things. So we'll move on to our next story. And that story, that's actually an email from LD in Puerto Rico. Hello to Puerto Rico. Ask Dr. Dawn chronic lumbar pain. This is from yesterday. I have seen a doctor for chronic lumbar pain. He gave me meloxicam medication to take for my pain. He gave me a referral for an MRI of my lumbar spine pain. According to MRI results, I have a degenerative disease in my lumbar area. At this point, I have a follow-up appointment next Monday, October 27th, with my physiatrist. I'm still having pain. The pain is unbearable. Let's see what he says on the day of my appointment. What do you think of my condition? Well, Eldie, one thing is I would really, really love to know if you've had this pain for more than 6 months and if it's gotten worse recently or if you've just been living in it. I often will use this 1 to 10 scale because it just helps me understand what the person is experiencing. There's no way to objectively measure pain. It's a subjective phenomenon. But a couple of thoughts. First of all, take the meloxicam with food because it can burn a hole in your stomach or your small intestine. I don't know if you've had trials of muscle relaxants, gabapentine, Tylenol with or without hydrocodone, or acupuncture. I don't know if you've had physical therapy. I don't know what resources are available to you. But all of these other things should be tried to help you get out of pain. The other thing is, after the pain for more than 3 months, people start to develop secondary pains in other parts of their body because they're sleep deprived and they're beginning to develop fibromyalgia. So chronic pain is just the beginning of a chain of dominoes. People often stop exercising, they get weaker, that leads to imbalance in their muscles and other parts of their body. And of course, cardiac disease is also a possibility. So we need to get you moving. Just last week, I read an article about a type of therapy, a cognitive behavioral therapy that people were doing to make sure that people did work their way up to moving normally again. One of the things I worry about with your letter is that now that you have this MRI that says I have degenerative disease, you're feeling like you might be having to actually fix the degenerative disease or get some kind of surgery. And I want to start out with saying that it's not necessarily true that that MRI is a picture of your pain. Many people have degenerative changes in their spinal column and no pain. So I'll come back to that in a moment, but let's talk about what that means, degenerative disease, because it could mean several things. It could mean desiccation and shrinkage of the disc, and that causes the spinal column to deflate a little bit, and so the spaces where the nerves come out between the bones gets a little narrower. If you look at a picture of several lumbar vertebrae, that'll make sense to you. Another thing that happens after that shrinkage of the discs is some people develop extra bone around the joints where the vertebrae themselves articulate. And the extra bone narrows the hole, and so that can pinch the nerve. So the first question I ask when someone comes in with lumbar pain is there sciatica? In other words, is there evidence that the nerves are coming out are being pinched, or is it just the local nerves? And if there's sciatica, there's going to be a zebra stripe of vertical pain down the leg past the knee. And if you've got that, then your sciatic nerve is involved, and that situation definitely you have to take more seriously, although it can be caused by the nerve being pinched either at the spinal level, but it can also be caused by the nerve being pinched in the butt, where the butt muscles get short, and in some people there's essentially almost a scissoring action of the muscles. That's called piriformis syndrome, and that deep butt muscle is actually just when you tighten it, it's squeezing the nerve like a pair of dull scissors trying to cut an electrical cord. So do you have sciatica? Question number one. If you do, when to worry? And the first reason to worry is if there's numbness. Now, when a person's having, does it feel differently on the mirror image sides of the body? So if you're having pain in your left big toe and you take a little toothpick and tap on the left big toe and then tap on the right big toe, does that sharp toothpick feel differently? And the other thing you want to do is you want to do ice. So you'll put like a piece of ice a little higher on the leg and see if it feels just as cold on both sides, because you can also take out temperature sensitivity. And then that's a mild worry. The next thing you do is measure the calves. Are your calves different sizes? Is one calf visibly different? Take a tape measure and see. If your calves are different sizes, then you're beginning to have muscle atrophy. And the next question is, are you able to stand on your tiptoes? And are you able to walk on your heels with your toes off the ground? If you can do all of those things and you don't have sensory changes and you don't have the calf size difference, then it's pain. And in that situation, the image of your spinal degenerative disease is not realistically even a picture of your pain. It's so easy to get fooled here. Once upon a time, when CTs first came out, and it's even worse with MRIs because they're clearer pictures and they see more things, but they took an MRI machine to a shopping mall, and they basically, anybody who came through who was over 50 years old could get a free CT. And they had to fill out a little form that says, do you have back pain? And what they found was that the amount of degenerative disease in the people who had back pain and the amount in the people who didn't have back pain was about the same. So that's why you don't let yourself be talked into a surgery with the expectation that it's going to fix you. It's very important that you not fall for that, because I see a lot of what's called by the neurosurgeons a failed back. And a failed back is basically where the surgery didn't fix the person. And some of the failed backs people that I've seen turned out to have hip pain. They had hip arthritis, but it was referring atypically. And so it was thought to be back pain, and they got much better with a hip replacement. Other failed back people had musculoskeletal problems, piriformis syndromes, tendonitis, even infections, and they didn't need the surgery. So advice, keep moving. Try running in water. Get yourself a ski vest. If you're in Puerto Rico, you're not far from the ocean. Find a calm inlet or somewhere where you won't be bowled over by the waves, and run, do like you were jogging, but do it in water. This will help also lift your knees up and straighten them out. These will strengthen, you go and strengthen your abdominal muscles. Do sit-ups. The point is, if you strengthen the abdominal muscles, you actually help align your spine properly, and that can make a big difference. There's a set of exercises you can look up on the internet called McKinsey's exercises. These can be done at home, and given that you've already had an MRI that does not show any reason why you shouldn't do these exercises, I strongly recommend you do them. Another thing is to look at ergonomic, that's ergonomic, ergonomic measures for lumbar pain. There are pillows and certain kinds of things you can do with your car that can make a big difference. And oh, by the way, take your wallet out of your back pocket, because that can make a huge difference in whether in back pain. The last thing that you can do is you can look at refocusing your attention. Now, I have a short story here. It's a personal story. When I was in medical school, it's very stressful, and I started to get migraines, usually once a month around that time. But when it got to residency, it got much worse. And if I was on call and was going to have to go in and take care of patients at night solo, I was very stressed by that because I was afraid of making a mistake. And if I got the migraine on top of it, it wasn't like I could take time off. I had to learn how to work through the pain. And what I found was that you work very hard to put the pain, in my case, over there behind my left shoulder, and to focus on something on the right dominant part of my body, or vice versa if the pain's on the right side. But the idea is you focus really strongly on your left index finger, let's say, or your, and you look at it carefully and you touch it, and maybe you put, you run it on your lips, which are very sensitive and very high resolution part of your nervous system. You focus on your on breathing very slowly. And I know this sounds like very trivial and new age, but there's lots of research that shows that mindfulness meditation helps people deal with pain. And working with a physical therapist or even a friend who's a trainer, just getting someone to encourage you to move a little bit more, try heat and cold alternating. So you start with cold and icing, and then you move to heat, and then you move back to ice, and then you move back to heat, and always end with heat. But that particular technique can really make a difference because it kind of uses up the neurotransmitters, and it can allow your body to relax and the spasms to release, and it can make a big difference. I know I've gone on a long time, folks, but back pain is such a common problem. I think it's the second or third most common reason people go to see a primary care doctor. And I feel like the way we have primary care doctors right now on a hamster wheel, trying to see as many people as possible, it's all they can do, really, is to take out the prescription pad and maybe do a referral to physical therapy. They don't have a chance to explain to the patient exactly what's going on, and that knowledge is power, my friend, and understanding what's going on and what's not going on so you can get the fear out of the way. That's key. We have a caller on line one. Hello, what's your name and where are you calling from?
John from Santa Cruz.
Hey, John. What do you want to talk about tonight?
Well, it goes back a little bit about talking about the brain.
Sure.
And the adaptive nature of the areas of the brain. Did you ever hear of a guy named Dan Levitin?
I'm really bad at names. Tell me about his work.
Okay, what he did is he had a plan, and he took, and his basic layout was he took two individuals, one that plays music and one that did not. He put them both in physical functional MRIs, and he asked them both the same questions, and by the way the brain lit up, he could say, you play music and you don't, because of the training that they went through using the auditory, the visual, and the kinesthetic components of, let's say, playing a guitar.
Mm-hmm.
It was a very interesting study, and he wrote a book about it, and I read that one, and it was very, very interesting. So whatever you do, you're going to become that. So if you practice music all the time, you can play music. If you, surf all the time, you can surf. That's just the amazing adaptability of the brain and how I wish we could get to a point where we could understand more of it. And I know you've heard that that what I think is a misnomer. We only use 10% of our brain. My thought is we use 100% of our brain, but only 10% in, like, what you and I are doing right now, communication, walking around, things like that. The rest of the brain is controlling everything else.
You know, what's really interesting, and I strongly, John, urge you to do it, is go look at pictures of brains by age. So if you look at the brain of a newborn, for example, and then mm-hmm. you look at, say, a grade school child and a teenager and an adult, what you see in the brain is that it actually builds additional layers, like a parfait. It starts off, I think, with 3 layers at birth, and then you double that, and the complexity of the synapse, you can, take a slice of dead brain and stain it and look at this under a microscope, and there are great photos of this, and it starts to look very much like those boards that people used to do when they were, like, inventing a circuit board, back in the Radio Shack days, where you would kind of have a board and you could plug things in and try to figure out how to connect them. And then you would build, before chips, people would build boards. And that's really what it looks like, a really complicated board, but it's 3D chess. It's not just one layer. It's multiple layers, and they all communicate. Now, here's an interesting thing. Just like the old boards where you could just pull out a plug and plug it in somewhere else, there's an amazing amount of brain plasticity that still remains into adulthood. And there's this one study that I love. It was done maybe 15 years ago, and I certainly don't remember who did it. But, of course, it was done on college students, so it's done on young people. I'll be, clear about that. But they basically were blindfolded for about 2 weeks, and they had a partner who led them around and fed them and helped them do whatever they need to do, because they were really bad at everything that requires vision. And over the course of 2 weeks, and they were doing functional MRI, so they were watching what happened to the visual cortex. And what happened to the visual cortex is it started responding to sound. The auditory cortex basically said, oh, look, there's some vacant parking spaces over there. I think I'll extend some synapses into that and increase my processing power. And so people who are blind from birth, for example, can sometimes have really incredible echolocation properties. So they're able to construct a 3D space in their head based on sound, and they become very good at it. And they're using, to do that, they're actually using repurposed visual cortex that's just not doing anything. That plasticity even exists in older age. I mean, I watched my husband's brain recover from a terrible infection that blinded him, and he still has a big hole in his brain, but he's rewired his visual cortex, and he just basically sees around it, just like what I was talking about earlier with the hallucinations and the illusions where the brain's just completing what's missing. That's happening a lot. And I see it every day in my husband. And, of course, I'm enormously grateful for his recovery. But the fact of that recovery in a 71-year-old man is also very impressive. So, high-level rehab, as much rehab. If you have a stroke or a brain injury, folks, you don't need just a couple of hours a week. You need intense all the time. Rehab, 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 because You can rewire your brain, but it's hard when you're older. You have to really work at it. Like the old joke about music and getting to Carnegie Hall, right? Practice, practice, practice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. excuse me. The name of that book was Your Brain on Music by Dan Levitin.
Your Brain on Music. Well, you know, we have a lot of fans of music here at K-Squid, so it wouldn't surprise me at all if there are a lot of people out there nodding their heads. One of the things that people who have mild cognitive or even early Alzheimer's can do, by the way, to help retain their function is to learn a new musical instrument. That's probably because, as you said, it ties together visual, kinesthetic, and auditory cortices, and it goes across both sides of the brain. So something about learning something new and bouncing stuff all over the brain to do it, it seems to, I don't know, metaphorically dust off the circuitry and allow it to function more efficiently. But it's not just the new skill. It's also the performance on standard cognitive testing that improves. And it's one of the few things that actually improves it.
And it's communication. There was an Arab and an Israeli guy, and they were at odds with each other all the time. And, you know, fight and all that. And then they each found out that they played music. And they got together and they became best friends because they had a method of communication.
That's a nice story. Let's all make beautiful music together. Maybe we, I'm thinking back to the demonstrations in the 60s. And, you know, there seems like they played a lot of music at those demonstrations. I don't know if the No Kings demonstrations had music, but it'd probably be a darn good idea.
Yeah. Yeah, they had costumes.
Well, those are fun too. I saw a really funny thing with Kermit the Frog as the leader of the Frog Resistance. It was very funny. I've got another call coming in, so I'm going to say goodnight.
Okay.
All right.
All right. Thank you for your help.
Thank you. Hello, and caller number two, you are on the air. Can you hear me?
Hello, dear doctor. This is Aline Smith calling.
Well, hello, Aline. Nice to hear from you.
I'm not a sickly person, but I'm, for the last 8 days, it's gotten better. Wondered if you could add to my what little knowledge I've gotten about what to do about a chest cold.
Okay, well, let's talk about upper respiratory stuff. You still got a lot of phlegm?
I guess so. I have to guffaw it all out and from time to time and blow my nose.
Blowing your nose a lot. And let's give it to me in cooking terms. Are we talking like Greek yogurt? Are we talking pudding? Yeah, but how gooey is it? Is it like like honey, or is it like maple syrup, or is it like water? I mean, what's the goo factor? Because that gives... The color is important.
Whitish, kind of more like coconut oil.
Coconut oil.
Coconut chilled.
Well, coconut oils, I'm not looking at color, honey. I'm looking at texture.
Oh, right.
So, like, if I have a salad dressing that's got a lot of emulsifier in it, it's kind of goopy, or like ketchup is kind of goopy.
Yes.
And then there's just plain milk, which is runny.
Yes.
And so between goopy and runny.
This is goopy.
Okay, so we need to de-goop you. No, seriously, it'll help. It'll help with your symptoms.
The phrase. I mean, the word.
So we're gonna have you use some mucus thinning agents. And so my favorite one of these is called guaifenesin. That's G-U-A-I. F-E-N-E-S-I-N. And this is an expectorant. So it thins mucus and it makes it easier to clear it because particularly if it's coming out of your nose when you lie down, it's going down the back of your throat. It's getting trapped in the airways and it's triggering a cough because your natural defense mechanisms don't want that goo to get down into your lungs because then it infects your lungs. And our big concern, particularly in an older person, is secondary bacterial infections. Mm. So I don't want to get personal, but I'm going to get personal. You've had your flu shot. You're up to date on your COVID and your RSV, right?
No, I'm not.
Okay. So Dr. Dawn is asking you to take care of that. All right. Because we're just heading into cold and flu season. You're early. And the secondary infection, basically what happens is you get all this goo, and that's bacteria chow. So you've got a viral infection when the phlegm is white or clear, except maybe first thing in the morning, you've got a viral infection. And those, they stink, but they don't generally kill. I mean, COVID being an exception, of course, but nevertheless, I'm sure you tested for that. And the thing is, the secondary bacterial infections are really nasty, and they plant themselves in that phlegm and goo that's down in your lungs, and that sustains them. That gives them enough food and energy that they can grow into, you know, a large goober of bacteria, and then they've got the energy to start trying to invade your tissues and basically eat your lungs. And, yeah, not sounding good, is it?
How do you spell that medication? G-U...
A-I.
A-I.
F-E. F is in Frank. F-E.
D.
Frank Edward.
Oh, F.
F. E.
E.
N.
N.
E.
E.
S.
S.
I.
I.
N is in Nancy.
N. Oh, God.
I know, spelling. But anyway, that is available in pill form, in liquid form. It's actually the main ingredient in plain Robitussin. But they have some nice 12-hour versions of that that are very nice. The other thing I want you to do is hydrate like crazy, lots of fluids.
Oh, yeah.
And if you aren't allergic to chicken and or a vegan, chicken soup actually works.
Mm.
And it helps clear the mucus. So that's a very good thing. All right.
Hello.
Oh, we do have a caller on the line. Well, I don't know. You bounced Aline off the line, and I don't quite know what happened. My bad, I'm sure. Who are you, and what can I do for you tonight?
Hi. My name's Ian.
Hi, Ian.
I'm calling just to ask a simple question about a medicine you were talking about, but I did not get. Before I do that, I just wanted to ask you if you have ever heard of a book called This Is Your Brain on Music?
Actually, that was just talked about.
Yes, that was, I just wanted to maybe fill in the information. I didn't hear the caller really identify who Daniel Levitin is. Mm-hmm. He's a musicologist. He's got a laboratory he runs. It's called Music Perception Cognition and Expertise at McGill University. He's also a musician, neurologist. He's done, you know, things with Blue Oyster Cult and David Byrne. So he also wrote another New York Times popular bestseller called The World in Six Songs. So I just kind of wanted to fill that information.
It sounds like you really enjoyed that book. Is that right?
I enjoyed both of them. I think he is just absolutely a must read for people who are interested in the linkage between music and brain.
Okay. Thank you very much for that. Did you have a question too?
Yes. My question was, you mentioned a medicine that was an alternative for fluoride to help prevent cavities, and I didn't get what
you
said.
Yeah, that is hydroxyapatite, and it's so that's hydro and then X Y A P A T I T E. So hydroxyapatite, like having a good appetite, but with all A's and one P. There's one brand name. Yeah, go ahead.
Is this over the counter?
Yes, it's over the counter.
Okay.
And I have seen it. The brand name that was in this article is Apadent. Apadent. I don't know if that's available in the United States, but if you just search hydroxyapatite toothpaste, I think it'll.
Okay.
Some friendly web server will be happy to show you where you can buy it. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.